Wait, let me do it. For those who can't see Steve, he looks off to the left as his mind wanders, and he says, what are we doing today? What are we talking about, and how can I frame this in the most majestic-sounding way? So this is my impersonation of Steve.
Today, so here I go. I'm looking out the window, and I am framing the conversation today as a discussion around something you've heard of in the news. It's been there. It's been out there. It's been controversial maybe in some places, but it's really not. It's a straightforward kind of idea that we need to be talking about today. It's Christian nationalism. Stay tuned. We got a good one for you. How was that, Mark?
That was excellent.
We act like we're professionals, but we're not. We're goof-offs, and that's why you love us. I'm Stephen D. Martin, the Reverend Stephen D. Martin. I just get to hang out here. Reverend Mark Flynn is the real talent. How you doing, Mark?
That I have business cards that say that. Real talent.
The real talent?
Found
somebody sent me a business card that I apparently had in seminary that I've forgotten all about. I was a youth director at the time, and it actually said, you know, Steve Martin, the mild and lazy guy.
Nice.
So, yeah, goes all the way back to those days. All right, today we're talking about something that, yeah, like I said, it's in the news. It's a hot topic. It used to be used as kind of a byword, as a kind of thing, but people have been picking it up and saying, oh, well, no, I am a Christian nationalist, and here's why, and that's a good thing. And we're going to get into that today. It's like all things these days, there's like two different understandings of what anything means. So yeah, Christian nationalism. Oh, and the real big news is... Well, Neil Christie, you know, is just one of my favorite guests, and Neil actually likes being on this podcast, which I just can't really wrap my head around. But Neil is going to, you know, he's going to become kind of a regular feature here, joining in the conversation, bringing a little bit of a different perspective from the National Church, and yeah, pretty cool. Right,
it
Mark?
Is cool. I love Neil. I think he brings a great perspective that I need, and... It's like, you know, iron sharpens iron. It has that whole quality of whenever we talk, I feel better about understanding my own thoughts better. He helps identify things within me, and I love that when I'm around people like that.
I remember when I first met Neil, he was working at the General Board of Church and Society, and I went up there and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like a church agency that's actually doing stuff. And yeah, it kind of blew me away. And so he was my, you know, main contact there, and I kind of grew to really respect him. And now, you know, to be able to call him a friend, and for him to actually want to join a little bitty podcast like this one, it's pretty cool. I'm digging it. It's I feel good about my life, really. Yeah.
Then I'm even more excited. I was excited
this long pregnant pause.
I mean,
you didn't know what to say, did you?
I really am actually sitting here wondering what Neil will bring to the table when it comes to Christian nationalism, that topic. You know, I was getting ready for the podcast, walking up here to Jeff's office, it hit me that Christian nationalism holds the special place as being a category in my mind that has done as much damage to the church as Calvinism. And that's very few things that I can say that about, if not more so. So,
all right. So we know how you feel.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a good one. I did a film on a version of Christian nationalism a few years ago. So something I've been thinking about for a long time, although we didn't really call it that back in those days in the mid 2000s, we didn't really have the language for around Christian nationalism like we do today. So that's going to be fun. Hey, I want to catch everybody up on a little news. You know, we have rock stars here on this podcast sometimes. And by the way, as far as regular speakers and stuff, I've gotten more positive feedback about the podcast we did with Jenny and Denna about, you know, Advent stuff. Can we like do that once a month, or not Advent, but you know, just have do that same kind of thing?
Yes, once love a month? That idea. I love that.
All right. Well, one of our other guests I can't remember if we actually mentioned this while he was on the podcast or not, but Reverend Rob Shank, a friend of mine who is going through some interesting trials and tribulations these days. He was on our podcast talking about the price of repentance and changing one's mind, especially in a place like Washington, D.C. And, since then, there has been a very major piece in the New York Times that has featured him as a whistleblower into misdoings at the Supreme Court. Last week, there was an episode of The Daily, New York Times, The Daily podcast, which is, I think it's the most popular, most listened to podcast in the world. He was there on that one, and it was more about the personal side of his activities during that time when he was head of an agency or a nonprofit that was really quite effective in influencing the Supreme Court, especially on the conservative side. And tomorrow, because of all that, tomorrow he is testifying before Congress. So I'm going to go and I joked with him. I'm going to be his George Tenet to his Colin Powell. I'm going to be that guy that's kind of, you know, looming in the back behind the camera. But it's the House Judiciary Committee, that's going to be an interesting experience. And I've talked to Rob quite a bit, and you know, I like saying things to people, saying nice things to people when I feel like I want to say nice things, because sometimes we don't tell people what we really look up to and admire about them. We don't always do that, you know, and then we wish we had. And so I'd really try to make it, a practice to tell people things when I think good things about them. And Rob really is demonstrating, he is in a position of demonstrating Christian repentance in a way that I've never seen before and on a scale that I've never seen before. And I am going there to the hearing tomorrow just to support him in that endeavor. Pretty amazing stuff to be sitting here and having this conversation at all.
It is amazing. And if you look at who are the members of that committee, Nadler from New York is the chair, but you have people like Hakeem Jeffries, the new incoming speaker, sits on that committee. You have some people that aren't the brightest bulbs in the box. Jim Jordan is on that committee. Don't get me started on him. But yeah, I mean, it's a really important committee in the House.
And let me tell you a little backstory on some of this that's really quite the God moment. I mean, when we both talked about it last week, when I talked with Rob about this, we both got chills talking about it. A big part of Rob's conversion, his latest conversion, he likes to talk about having three different conversions in his life. And his latest conversion had to do with him being in a subject of a film on gun violence with that Abby Disney produced. And his counterpart in this film was a woman who lost her son to gun violence in Florida, a woman named Lucy McBath. And Lucy is a friend of mine, good friend of Rob's. Her activism propelled her to run for Congress in Georgia. She is actually on that committee. She is going to be one of the representatives that will be facing Rob. And it's almost like, you know, it's just unbelievable to see these kinds of these strange little currents in life all come together and merge over something like this. So unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. It is. So Godspeed to you tomorrow as you go support Rob and pray that his conversion experience will move members of that committee to do the right thing.
and move all of us to let's put this one out there. Maybe his example might move some people in Washington, D.C. to feel better about changing their own minds.
It's a shock to me that we've come to the place, as smart as we are as a culture, that we have come to this place that to have a different opinion than one you had 5 years ago because you have learned something new is completely anathema in the Washington, D.C. power struggle. To change your mind is seen as weakness, as opposed to, education, wisdom, the thought that we grow when we get new knowledge. That's just still amazes me.
And as part of Christianity, we talk about, you know, transformation. We talk about metanoia. We talk about
sanctification.
Growing more holy. In grace, you know, yeah. Conversion. Once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. You know, that's a fairly central part, especially to the kind of Christianity that we celebrate.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
All right. Well, but I think that's an important thing to lift up today. You know, so everybody knows that, you know, Mark, you're a really big deal. I mean, you know, you are a big deal, and people want to come be part of this podcast that you have. So
that is such a good, humble statement, considering you bring all these people to the podcast because you know them. Hey, let me introduce you to Mark. That's how it goes around here. So, but thank you. You're very kind and sweet, and you lie well. So.
What's going on at the church? That's a really good stuff.
Well, welcome to Advent. There's too much going on. That's how it feels like. I can smell downstairs. They are preparing for the Wednesday night distribution. They make 180 meals, so that's going on. This Saturday, we have the Christmas parade, the Oak Ridge Christmas parade that's happening. If anybody's interested in being a part of that, you need to contact Shelby Fowler this week. On Sunday afternoon, we have the Chancel Choir Christmas concert. This is an extraordinarily big, important event where we hear the beautiful music, and Josh has done so much with a choir and orchestration, and that's all Sunday at 4:00. You don't need tickets like we've had in the past, but seating's going to be limited, so come early. And Miss Shelby wanting to give families an opportunity to come and be together prior to that concert, she's having a children's Christmas party on that same Sunday, this coming Sunday, from 2:30 to 3:30. Well, I'll be in the multi-purpose room and playing games, decorating sugar cookies, having a hot chocolate bar. There's a question. What do you put in your hot chocolate? When she said that we're going to have a hot chocolate bar, my first thought is, what do you put in hot chocolate other than hot chocolate? I'm not a marshmallow guy. I'm not a peppermint stick guy.
Nights where they're talking about having the chocolate fountain at their wedding. Yeah. Oh.
What do you put in your hot chocolate? I put hot chocolate. That's it.
I don't have hot chocolate very often, but when I do, I just kind of like it like I like my coffee. I like it kind of, you know, straight up with no additives. That's the way I like it. Yeah,
exactly. You want coffee to taste like coffee, the way God made it. Thank you very much. And hot chocolate should taste like hot chocolate, you know?
Yeah,
whatever. Get off my lawn. So that's what's happening.
Problems with you people. Now you're going to hear about it.
See, we got to have the Festivus. Quote.
That's right, I mean, the Festivus. And we have more things coming up. Look on the church's website to learn more. We have a service of lamentation and hope for people who are really struggling this time of year. That'll be Sunday night, the 18th. And then, of course, we not only have Christmas Eve services, but just to remind all of you, we're having an extra service this year on the Thursday before Christmas. We're having, I think that's the 22nd. We're having an additional Christmas Eve service on Thursday, a few days early, because we have a lot of people who leave town who never get to experience communion and candlelight in our sanctuary, which really is beautiful. It is. You've heard Steve talk about it. It is an extraordinarily beautiful place. So we're having that extra service on Thursday to just make sure everybody has that opportunity.
It's something I really, you know, don't want to miss. And I'm so glad I'm going to be in Oak Ridge this weekend. for Woo-hoo. Autograph signings and things like that.
book tour brings you through. Tour. I love that.
Yeah. No, but I'm so thrilled that I get to be around for the Christmas concert Sunday. That's just really going to make it. I think the Christmas season, the Advent season, really will begin. Because we hadn't decorated. We hadn't done anything. Yeah.
Annette drug everything out, but we haven't really decorated yet. So,
all right. So we're yakking a little way too much right now. We're actually sitting here waiting for our guest to join the conversation because his, we mixing schedules up and so on. And
he's a busy man. He's a busy man.
Yeah. So, again, our guest today is the Reverend Neil Christie. Who has one of those really fancy titles that I can't remember all of it. But he is essentially, right up there with the bishop of the Baltimore-Washington Conference. He's in that office and doing a lot of good social justice work. And Neil is, Neil has a perspective on everything that we want to talk about. So we welcome Neil. Hey, there he is. Awesome. There, just in time.
Perfect.
Welcome, timing. Neil. How you doing today?
Hey, man. Coming from the mother church of Methodism, Lovely Lane United Methodist Church.
No kidding.
That's where I came from, and I'm back in Washington, D.C.
All right. Well,
we're glad you're here. We are glad you're here.
We got really tired of talking, just the two of us. And people are tired of us talking, too, so they're ready to see the thing shifted.
Let's talk.
So I want to ask, can I start, Mark? I want to start. I want really, really down, very basic kind of understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
Just like a very basic kind of definition.
I'm happy to do it. I mean, I look to organizations that have been doing this work long term. I mean, we certainly can look at what the United Methodist Social Principles say, and I want to be able to give you that in a couple of minutes, but I look to organizations like this, the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, the American, you have to edit that.
No way.
American, right. American Baptist office that deals with
the Baptist Joint Committee.
The Baptist Joint Committee. It's a long day, but the Baptist Joint Committee, and other good people of faith, Christian people of faith, have started an organization called Christians Against Christian Nationalism. And in all of the literature that I've been looking at recently, and there's some excellent folks from Religious News Service, like Jack Jenkins, who's been tracking this phenomenon, we have a modern version of a very long phenomenon, right? The notion of American exceptionalism is nothing new. Manifest destiny is what we called it growing up when I was in sixth grade. Now we'd call it the doctrine of discovery. Our indigenous sisters and brothers, our siblings, remind us of the doctrine of discovery through papal bull and through economic systems that legitimated the Christianization of this continent. But what I really, really appreciate about Christians Against Christian Nationalism is they really define it as a worldview and as a cultural framework. And so I want to share with you just really briefly some of the indicators of what Christian nationalism is. So they define it this way. So Christian nationalism.
Well, stop. I'm gonna put the brakes on, man. You're wound up. You're coming out of DC traffic. Gonna slow down because nationalism. Let's just break that. We know what the word Christian
means.
But let's talk about just nationalism. What is nationalism, and how is it different from patriotism? Okay.
I mean, I think so. I think that, I don't know, Mark. For me, I think as a pastor, I'm very cautious when it comes to attaching my full faith in any entity beyond my limited understanding of who Jesus Christ is. and Jesus Christ is Lord, right? Not just of my life, but of the cosmos, which includes the nations and the countries and creation and the peoples and the tribes and ethnicities and race, all of us. So I have a real hard time with putting all my faith in any one nation or national ideology. And so, and we see that, then we can get right to Christianity. It's like Christian nationalism supported apartheid in South Africa. Christian nationalism is on the rise in many countries, including not just the United States, but Russia. So this is a phenomenon that's not limited to our country. It's not limited to the global north or global south. It is a worldview that it's a threat really to religion, is properly practiced, and it's not healthy for any country that wants to live into what a democratic ideals are.
They're not saying, as Christian nationalists, other countries are not saying, yeah, the United States is, you know, the best, the, you know, God's favored nation. They're saying their own country is.
Exactly.
So how can you have a worldwide Christianity, which, by the way, when you say that God is the Lord of creation, God, that means that God is also, Jesus is the Lord of that galaxy way out there, you know?
Right.
But that's when you also say cosmic, it's cosmic, right?
That's the bottom line, is what they've done is said, what most, if you put it in simple terms, what matters most, and I'll put it in terms of American context, what matters most is what's best for America. And we'll use Jesus when he's helpful, and we'll cast him aside when he's not. When Jesus helps benefit us, holding on to privilege and power, we'll pull out Jesus. But as soon as we start talking about Jesus saying, turn the other cheek and love your enemies, well, no, that doesn't help America. Therefore, the bottom line is not what Jesus calls us to, but what is best for America growing in power and stature, and what also happens to be what's best for my group of people, white Christians, to maintain the power and authority in that nation. You can do the very same thing in Russia or South Africa. That's all doing the same thing. They're saying, let's use Jesus when it's convenient and toss him aside when he's not.
Yeah. And then, so the challenge for me is then, so it's our image of who Jesus is.
Right.
It's Christology. I mean, we've got warped Christologies out there. And the problem is it's seeped into our mainline church. I'm concerned when it seeps into our mainline churches. If it's on the fringe, and we can name it as folks that I probably identify as part of a mainline church denomination, which we are, United Methodist Church. It's a Big Ten church, but we're a mainline church. We take the intellect seriously. We believe in science, right? But when it comes into the mainline sanctuary, that's problematic for me, significantly problematic for me. And so it's either going to be coming in through these oppressive ideologies, so these anti-immigrant ideologies or anti-refugee ideologies, white supremacy ideologies, those that condone any form of police violence, I'm going to keep naming it now, that condone police violence toward black Americans, African Americans, or distrust of any racial inequality in the criminal justice system, believing that the criminal justice system is perfect. These kinds of tactics, in my opinion, they're connected to Christian nationalism. And it's not a surprise that folks that gravitate toward those beliefs that are regressive, I'm not going to say conservative, regressive, also are attracted, many people are attracted to Christian nationalism, and that's problematic.
So I wanted to throw this out there, a little image, something that I've learned, you know, over my many years. I had a friend of mine who's British. He's very British and very much, you know, a subject of the crown and so on. And he just out of nowhere says, do you know what the difference between etiquette and manners is? I said, I don't know. Hit me. And he said, manners is inclusive. Manners extend kindness and bring people in, whereas etiquette are rules that try to keep you out, right? And where I'm going with that is that image just stuck with me for one thing, but I also want to go back to the patriotism and nationalism thing. And I wonder if, and I'd love to get both of your take on this, patriotism. I mean, it's good to be patriotic. It's good to love your country. It's good to care about, you know, having a better society, but ultimately it's inclusive, right? It is, to be patriotic is to bring people in, to wish goodness for the country, for other people.
Yeah.
Whereas nationalism is more of an us against them kind of thing. What do you think of that?
I think nationalism lends itself toward authoritarianism, and tactics that demand people will show respect for national symbols and traditions as a certain select group of people who define history a certain way, an elite way, define it. And so that authoritarianism, I think, is what is where folks will gravitate toward with nationalism. But patriotism doesn't need to be authoritarian. It can be democratic. I think that's a big difference.
The practical side I see is, quite a few times in my life as a pastor, I have said to somebody, they'll say, oh, well, we should do this, meaning, and I'll say, isn't it interesting how you, when you say we, you start with this assumption of America, yeah, not we, the church. And you are more than capable of saying, at some point, I've had multiple people say, well, I don't care what Jesus says, I'm going to vote for that. In other words, that to me is a bottom line. When you set aside what you know Jesus would have you do, because you have decided it's not good if we do that for our country, then you are already 2 feet into Christian nationalism. You've already set aside Jesus in favor of your desire for the nation.
But I'm also wondering about people who will say, well, this is what Jesus would say, right? In other words, if Jesus doesn't, that Jesus would say a federal government should declare the United States a Christian nation, Jesus would be in favor of that. I guess that's where I think folks have truly skewed who Jesus is, that they are, that there's this notion of, there's no way to distinguish between their vision of Jesus and their vision of the nation.
Yes, that's and that is sad, because when they say that, they don't mean, oh, we should be a Christian nation. Absolutely. Let's drop the defense spending and spend it on social services for people.
Yeah.
Jesus, who says, turn the other cheek, hell yes, sign me up for that nation. But that's not what you mean by a Christian nation. You're talking about doing conservative values, not Jesus values.
Well, yeah. And that God has a particular plan for this nation. So the language of the success of the United States is part of God's plan. I mean, you hear that, that's Christian nationalism. That's not patriotism. The federal government should advocate for Christian values, as if Christian values somehow are so utterly distinct from Muslim and Jewish values, and those two, to name two of our sibling traditions alone. It's like, what is it that they really mean by Christian values? You know,
they mean those things that kept my grandfather in power, and I want to.
Yeah, or kept your grandfather out of power.
And kept, that's right.
He didn't have the money. He may have had the skin, but he didn't have the skin, right, skin color. But he didn't have the money. He didn't own the land, or didn't have the education. The other piece I don't want us to lose is Christian nationalism. Like, it seeps its way into families and family systems. So the notion that men are better suited for all leadership roles, while women are better suited to care for children in the home, is a general precept of Christian nationalism. That's what I would argue. Sure, we have Christian nationalists who are representatives that are serving now in government, who say we should be a Christian nation. I believe in Christian nationalism, but These are truly patriarchal values, that there's a role for women and there's a role for men. It's been ordained by God. I mean, this is significant. This is really problematic, because when the church doesn't question it, and again, it seeps into the mainline church, it's now here. It's not out there. And what are we doing in our mainline church, in the United Methodist churches in particular, to dismantle it? I guess, Mark, that's my question for you. Is a pastor in a significant church, how do you dismantle this in the context of your own local church?
Okay, before we get to the dismantling piece, I really love that question. That feels like that's really, you know, kind of a part two of this podcast question. But can you, each of you, give us an example of what Christian nationalism in the mainline church might look like?
I'll give you a perfect beginning point. Is every church I've been a part of until I came to Oak Ridge had American flags in the sanctuary. Yeah. And I would say, tell me about that. Why do you have an American flag? Well, it's because we're a Christian nation and we ought to celebrate. And I said, this is a worship service focused on God, not on America. How do we, do you think God is actually the God of all nations? Well, yes. And just talking people through that, but that's a perfect example of the assumption that we are Americans equal we are Christians. In their mind, there's no difference in that two conversation. That's the beginning point of a real problem. And that's how, to go back to what Neil was just asking, that's how I started, is talking about when you say Jesus is Lord, just dissecting that and saying, what do you think that means? If Jesus is Lord, Caesar is not. And that's a very clear biblical message. And Caesar may be the United States right now, but it's still Caesar. Yeah. You have to educate in that way of Jesus is Lord, the Christology of what that means.
I mean, yeah. I mean, to answer your question, Steve, it's like, for me, concrete would be a congregation that has, that either scapegoats or has caricatures and leads of our Muslim siblings, or participates in anti-Semitic language. I mean, we see a rise in anti-Semitism in the United States right now. It's connected to Christian nationalism. And I've heard this in our local churches, right? We're very polite church folks who mean well, will, you know, write off those who have different religious traditions and see that we have nothing in common. You know, why would we work with the Muslims? Why are we going to work with the Jewish community? I mean, to me, that is so, it's shocking, because that's not the way I'm an immigrant. I came out of necessity. We worked across the aisle. I mean, you learned how to do it for survival. But I've been in congregations where folks are just bewildered why I would say we need to be working with the Muslim community that's just this fledgling community just down the street, or the Jewish synagogue. Why are we working so closely with them?
The Ministerial Association in Oak Ridge, I was here, 15 years ago. It was a great ministerial association. It was included the Jewish population, the Baha'i faith, people of across the theological spectrum. I left, went to Chattanooga for 11 years in exile, came back to Oak Ridge, got here, and the Ministerial Association had shut down because several of the Southern Baptist pastors in town didn't want Jews as part of the Ministerial Association. Didn't think that, well, no, that's not right. We're Christians. We can't work with Jews like that. And it was that moment of, oh my God, that is such right in your face. That's really exactly what we're talking about.
It's just sort of, and it's there. So something is still allowing for that in the mainline traditions. Yes. I mean,
and there's little subtle things, and I always hate it when we get into these kind of semantic debates and say, well, you can't say this, but language is important, right? And words mean something, and they carry with them baggage that we don't always recognize. And so even to say the Old Testament and the New Testament, that is implying that, well, this is old. This is not as good. This is inferior because we have the New Testament. You know what I'm saying?
And this is when I had to learn in the last 6 years. Somebody saying, you know, that's wrong. Oh my God, you're right. It's that I never crossed my mind until about 6 years ago, and now I talk about Jewish scripture.
Yeah.
As opposed, it's a simple change, but are we ready to even think about and change how we do things?
Yeah, hard. That's the dismantling conversation for sure. But I just I'm always kind of amazed that when you really start thinking about this, how quickly it's you know, it's just kind of baked into our everyday language in so many different ways. And words, you know, have meaning, and words inform ourselves. Before we go to acknowledge our sponsor for today, which I you know is a very, very important thing for us to do, I want to ask Neil, you hinted at this a minute ago, but what about what is Christian accept or American exceptionalism? Yeah, what's that?
God, yeah, I mean, from my understanding, it's like that God chose this nation just as God, and it's rooted. They try to root it. Folks try to root it in Scripture, right? They try root it in the first books of the Bible, right? In the Hebrew Scripture, and then going through what the except for the prophets, going through the book of the law and the conquest stories. The notion that God has foreordained the United States to conquer and to Christianize whatever land the empire chooses to occupy. And so that notion of that we are beyond critique for this, because this is what God wanted. And this is what supported colonialism, neocolonialism, settler colonialism, all different forms of colonialism. And it's not only heinous, not only heresy, now considered heresy by churches, including the Catholic Church, and I believe most, at least the mainline churches, I'm not going to say the other, but the mainline churches, but it's
the good churches.
it's still in our thought, isn't it? That God must have put me here for a reason, or put us here for a reason. And my people have been here, and we've struggled. We've paid the price. And I get, there's a part of me which is like, wants to empathize with where that sense of, it's got to come, for some people, for folks that are disenfranchised, don't feel like they've got the power of elites. That's where my heart goes out. That's where I want to be curious. That's where I want to understand. Because guess what? They probably have a lot more in common and struggle that with me than they do with people of their own color and coming from their own, perhaps even their own state, right? We may have something more in common. And it has to do with economics. It has to do with the environment that we live in that's broken, and the environmental degradation that's happened. It has to do with the rise in rise in addictions. It has to do with incarceration. It has to do with all of these issues that we're dealing with. We have much more in common than what could separate us. And yet it becomes this message. It's a good sales tactic, right? To get folk to believe you're not like them. You're better. And if you're white, and you know, you're superior. And look at your people. Look at what we've accomplished. And totally negating the history. Totally negating the history, of course. So it's a great right now. Christian nationalism is a good selling point for a lot of folk, and that's my concern. It's like people need to see it for what it is. It's a sales technique. It's a sales technique used by politicians, by folks that want to benefit from the system. But the problem is, it starts with those politicians, and it seeps into the rest of our society. For congregations, for some churches that claim that they are Christian nationalists, it's heresy. This is contrary to the gospel of Jesus Christ for us. So, but when it seeps into our churches, that's where I have a serious problem. So,
and after we hear from the sponsor, I think that's part of this conversation, whether it's today or next time, how the church has benefited from Christian nationalism, the mainline church has benefited, and why we're so hesitant to come out and name it as evil.
Yeah.
Name it as sin. That's a good part of this conversation.
4 out of 10 Americans believe that this is a Christian nation. 4 out of 10. That's according to Pew. That is a serious study that was recently done. We got to name it, and we got to unpack it.
Well, lots of passion in this conversation today. It's nice. I like it. I hope you know, if you're still with us, listener, we're glad you've had the stomach for this kind of passion today. But you know, we always, you know, you talk about sales techniques, Neil. You know, again, you know, sponsoring a podcast, what a great sales technique that is. And our sponsor today Can the Church Be Saved is brought to you today by the Liturgical Police, right? For 1,500 years, our volunteers have been present wherever Christians worship, sharing the good news that there is a right way to do things, our way, and to issue verbal reprimands. Have either of you ever dealt with or, you know, encountered the liturgical police?
Why, yes, Steve.
Oh, why not? Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's amazing people would be so, you know, so passionate about liturgy and doing it right. But, you know, do you return the bulletin with mistakes circled in red?
That's a little close to home.
critiquing the worship space that somehow it harms my soul. I mean, there's something. I've heard it all.
The liturgical police. Are you a voice of reason, courageously pointing out that no one in the congregation has ever sung that second hymn? Do others rely on you to remind them how much better worship was in the past?
Oh, man. Welcome to First Oak Ridge.
If so, you may already be one of us. Register at our website and receive a free liturgical police badge you can wear into any church you visit. It's shaped like an immature Christian pointing an index finger at others.
I love that line.
Yeah. Make a difference. Help others know their failures. Join the liturgical police today. We may not be able to arrest you, but we have the power to make you miserable. The liturgical police. We have the best sponsors on this podcast.
I love that one.
Yeah. It's astounding.
How much should we give?
You have to talk to a First Methodist ad sales representative to get the answers to that. Yeah, it's all negotiated, right. You know.
Right. For you, my friend, we'll make a deal.
That's right. We make you a good price. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, now let's all we're gonna grab our big glass of water and we're gonna take a little sip, you know, together. Mark, where's your glass of water?
I drank my coffee early, so I've had energy.
You did. I'm loaded. Okay, so back into it, guys. This is key because this is I don't think this is just a regular kind of a theological. It's definitely a theological conversation, but I don't think it's just a theological conversation because I think this is one of those times where theology really does have consequences. And yeah. I want to pull out a word that is loaded. We've already heard the words heresy. We've heard, you know, some other kind of loaded words that betray our passion about this. But I want to ask you about another word, and that is idolatry. Mm-hmm. What is idolatry? Is it, you know, we kind of grow up in Sunday school, you know, thinking, oh, it's a little statue that's, you know, that somebody worshipped as a god. It's the golden calf in the desert, you know, that the Israelites made and they worshipped this golden calf. But what really were we talking about when we're talking about idolatry?
You know, I remember quite often when people would ask that and I'd be teaching a class and I'd look around the sanctuary and the only little statue you could ever see that you could use as an example would be the American Eagle on top of the flagpole on the flag sitting in the worship service, and say, is that an idol? Oh, no, that's not an idol. I'd say, oh, do people sacrifice their children in honor of it? Do they send their children to war and die for that nation? Well, yeah. So tell me, what's an idol then?
I can't top that. That's good. That's powerful. I mean, idolatry, putting anything before Jesus, right? It's Where is Jesus? And we know Jesus through our experience, but we know Jesus through the text. And it's really hard for me to imagine Jesus siding with Rome. I don't think, I never saw Jesus side with Rome. There are times, you know, maybe it would have been a lot easier. But isn't it interesting? It was only after he died and after several centuries that Christians sided with Rome. But Jesus never sided with Rome. And he never sided with the national, you know, appointees, the designees, Herod. Didn't do it. So where does that leave us? I mean, how far we have come from that. How do we get back to that?
Well, yeah, and so, it goes back
so
to what
I can think of several kind of idols in big picture terms, and I just want to throw these out to ask what you think. Technology. Is technology an idol?
See, it's not.
Is it something we expect to be able to rescue us, to save us?
Yes.
Okay.
But I think people don't send their children to die for technology.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
No, we're willing to let other people in enslaved factories make technology for us, but it's not my children.
Coltan and cell phones. There you go. Coltan. So I was talking to a friend from the Democratic Republic of the Congo who was visiting. He works with the government, and he said, Neil, the artisanal mines that are pulling out diamonds and gold and coltan in the eastern part of the Congo, it just keeps going up and up, and it's being shipped off to China. It's not just China, Neil, it's the United States too. And so the children, I mean, how is the church responding? And this is the challenge. I mean, are we even conscious of how we participate in idolatrous practices? I don't know if we're always conscious of it, honestly.
See, that's just it. I don't think technology is the idol. I think our lifestyle is the idol.
It's the lifestyle. It's like to keep my technology going. The coltan in my cell phone. Who made this laptop? It's people would rather. I'd rather not know. There's a part of
Abraham.
Me.
And, that's right. Abraham and Sarah. Abraham gets this. Abram, is it Abram? Is he Abraham by this point, or is he Abram or what? But he takes this boy Isaac up to the top of the mountain, and that's like the ultimate, you know, test of are you really with me, God?
That's exactly right.
Right. It's and our children can even be idols that we place before God. So you know. So again. So is it possible that country, that nation, you know, is it can be idolatrous? It can, yes. Can we, you know, yeah, just go off on that, guys. I want to hear it. Lay it on me.
And it goes back to the perfect examples. You have churches around here that have 4th of July worship services. Well, okay, that just think that thought for a second. Worship. Who do you worship? You worship God. You worship Jesus. If on 4th of July you're worshiping the country, you're putting the nation literally in the place of God in those moments. I have no trouble saying, thank you, God, that we live in this nation and here are the blessings.
Yeah.
Pull us to be a better people. That's right. Different from setting Jesus aside when he's inconvenient.
I had a church where I didn't pastor this church, but I visited this one church where around the 4th of July, I think it was right before or right after, whoever was leading the service, whether it was the pastor or the lay leader, they had everyone stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance. As part of the worship service. That one threw me, guys. That one really threw me. I was like, this is a little surprising to me. And there had been some crises in that community. So they were coming through some hard times. And I get it. But the answer for them was the Pledge of Allegiance. You know, the other piece here are the hymns that we sing. I was thinking about this like before the break is, do we ever question those beautiful hymns that have been inherited, part of our tradition, but that kind of lend themselves to strong nationalism that may not be healthy? How often do we like use those hymns as sort of the conquering hymns and those messages? Rather than redeem the nation, right? So Forgive us for the sins, you know. Get us back on track, God. We've fallen short. I mean, no nation has not fallen short. The notion, the notion that God has sort of foreordained and blessed a nation, and there's no sin, is just like that's not the gospel. That's not the Hebrew text. That's not the Greek text. That's not there. So.
And be self critical enough to realize if someone said to you sitting in America, oh, you know, there's this group of people that in Russia that say God ordained Russia to be the leader of the world and to take over the world. God ordained England. God ordained the Congo. Any other nation, if they describe that, you'd think, well, what a bunch of loonies they are. That's not how God works. God doesn't do that. Be self-reflective enough to realize that's how you sound when you talk about the United States that way in the context of the gospel.
Yeah, here, but we tend to take it for granted. So when you think about how many, like, those seasons come around during the church year. So we have our church calendar, and if you're like me, I like to follow the church calendar. We started the new year with Advent, and I celebrate that. This is the start of a new church year. But the interjected with that are all these national celebrations as well. It could be Mother's Day. It can be Memorial Day. It can be the 4th of July. It can be, and this becomes problematic because I think people are torn. They feel, well, if we don't show that reverence in church, somehow we're disrespecting our national identity. Christian nationalism is based on identity, right? It's all about identity. And then worldview. And so how do people shape their primary identity as a Christian, especially in the worship space? How often do those secular celebrations sort of permeate? And Mark named it so well. It's in terms of the 4th of July, but when else during the year do we see those national celebrations sort of just permeate?
And that being said, I think it's important for us on days like Veterans Day or whatever.
Yeah.
I have no trouble saying, look to the veterans as the one example in our culture of people who are willing to die and give something of their life for a matter beyond themselves. There's great example. I have no trouble thanking God for the sacrifice veterans make.
I agree.
But you have to put that in the context of, but Jesus is Lord, and how does Jesus call us to live?
And then And then what do we do with countries with veterans on many sides, right? And if we're a global church like or a worldwide church like United Methodist Church, we have United Methodists in Vietnam. We have United Methodists in Laos. We have United Methodists in Russia. We have United Methodists in Ukraine. And so how much better it would be to find some common values around peace building, around as much as we're able within our political systems, critique of the political establishment, to come together, rather than to sort of give in to a Christian nationalism, whether we're here in the United States or whether in Ukraine, whether in Russia. And it's very challenging.
You know the problem? Here's a perfect example. When people travel overseas and someone asks them when they're in a different culture and somebody says, oh, tell me about yourself. The sad reality is we begin with, well, I'm an American, not I'm a Christian. That's all you need to know about how we frame our own identity.
Yeah.
Our citizenship to the United States quite often is forefront in our minds. And when we think about we collectively imagine is America, not we the church, which is a worldwide organization, what you're describing.
Yeah.
So we've got a few politicians, we've got some pastors, high-profile pastors who are saying, yeah, that's good. You know, Christian nationalism is, I believe that America has a special place in the world. I believe that God has a special purpose for America. And just again, kind of break it down theologically. What is actually wrong with that? What's wrong with that? Those kinds of statements.
I mean, I can tell you what the United Methodist Social Principles say. They
do
say
it,
that,
yeah, Do it.
I mean, I'll give you this, and it's very. This wasn't just written overnight. I mean, in 1968 to 1972, the United Methodist Church was dealing with what its future, what it would look like. It was dismantling racist structures that permeated it earlier. We continued to do that, but formally they were doing this. They were coming together with the Evangelical United Brethren. We're trying to look at what the future would be. And if I'm not mistaken, we met 2 weeks after Dr. King had been assassinated. So this is a tumultuous time when the General Conference met, yeah? And this is what it said in the first social principles back in 68 to 72, and it hasn't changed so far. While our allegiance to God takes precedence over all allegiance to any state, we acknowledge the vital function of governments as a principal vehicle for ordering of society. So we're not suggesting that there's not a role for governments and policies in the role of the state. We're not suggesting that. Well, we are saying that our allegiance to God has to take precedence over any political order, whatever that political order may look like. And it may be what we currently have in the United States, what they have in China, what they've got in Russia, what they've got in Brazil. Every political order is under the judgment of God. And we can discuss the pros and cons of any political order, but every single one of them is under the judgment of God. I have to believe that. If I don't believe that to start with as my starting point place and say my allegiance is to God first, then, I kind of get lost.
You know what's fascinating is when I began ministry, I felt like in the 40s and 50s, we were under this illusion coming out of World War II that America is a Christian nation.
Yeah.
America does things right. And we went through enough that in the early days of our ministry, after Watergate, after so much crisis, it was nobody in our churches were saying, well, we're a Christian nation. The government had done enough to piss off every single person at some level.
Yeah.
So they'd say, well, we do our best, and we were founded on Christian principles. People would have that conversation. It is fascinating to me now that we've come back around and have this group of politicians and even pastors, as you say, Steve, that are willing to take up that mantle again. It's like we've overlooked, we've become consciously ignorant of so much of what the United States, or any nation, I mean, we're talking about the United States context.
But this doesn't matter. Any nation, right.
It is any nation. You have to overlook so much history and so much reality going on, so much privilege and power being abused, to claim that Christian nationalist statement, that for me, when a pastor says it, it's a willful dereliction of duty, and they ought to be brought up on charges. They've abandoned their primary calling.
Yeah.
It's just so bad to give people that image that to be a Christian means to be a good citizen. That is so the opposite of what the gospel is about.
Well, and let's just remember that Jesus himself was a victim of the state. He was crucified. He was given a mock trial and a charge that put him in jail overnight and crucified the next day.
And Jesus was born stateless.
Right.
Jesus was born stateless and is a refugee. I mean, he immigrated. Depending on the gospel text we look at, he immigrated. He left as a child. Where did he go? I mean, it's fascinating. He left what he knew, or his parents, his family did, and he found refuge in another country. It's fascinating. There's no place where Jesus ever claims citizenship for himself to legitimate his message. Paul does that, but that's another whole other conversation as to why he does it and how he does it, right? But you don't see it with Jesus, and you don't see it with the disciples. Why didn't they? They never once claimed a certain citizenship to legitimate, like, the authority by which they were giving the gospel. The gospel superseded everything, economics, politics, social systems, family systems, everything. And so culture. And so it's like, why is it, and this goes back to Mark's comment and your original comment then, Steve, is like, why pastors and the representatives are now claiming it? And I see it as it's great salesmanship, number one, because it sells. Number two, yes. It's based on fear. It's based on people who feel so disenfranchised, they don't know where they belong anymore, so they want their identity back. And so they have to create this artificial identity that really never existed, but they're gonna create it anyway. Third, it's a way to bring people together. So you now have a sense of belonging. When people are feeling so disenfranchised or so diffuse because they don't know how to navigate the changes that are happening. So that's where the role of the church is for me. The church has got a name. Hey, these changes are happening. It's scary. It brings up fear. And your sense of identity is not based in your whiteness. It's not based in your citizenship. It's based in your belonging in this kingdom of God agenda. And what is that?
That's very well said.
Let's unpack it. Let's look at the parables in the context of today. Let's look at Jesus' sayings, the hard sayings, in the context of today. And then let's do some soul searching, friends. And then let's ask each other the hard questions, man. I mean, it's got to happen. And it's got to happen in local churches.
This could go on a while. I do feel like I need to wrap things up, you know, and I need to do a little shout out to our friends at the Institute on Religion and Democracy, who often listen to the podcast that Neil and I do. And I do want to
get to them.
here's what I want to make sure that they hear. Okay, we are not advocating the diminishment of the United States of America.
Lord, no.
We are not anarchists. We are not saying anything that is revolutionary here at all. I dare say, all three of us are very patriotic. We choose to live here. We love this country, yes. And we want to see it be, you know, live up to its promise and be a better place, okay?
Exactly.
But the Lordship of Jesus Christ is above all of that. And so, Mark Tooley, when you get ready to write us up here, we're going to, you know, we want you to know that we're Christians. We are followers of Jesus Christ. And that's what we would like to promote in the church so that, you know, we're not falling for lesser gods, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank
you.
We've
got to call our friends out when we can, you know. But, you know, others might want to hear that word, too. We are not disloyal. We are loyal first and foremost. And we hope everybody listening to this is loyal first and foremost to our hope is the God revealed in Jesus Christ.
Amen. Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been a hot one. We're waiting for the write-ups to come. You know, the Oak Ridger is going to publish a review, I think. No, they're not. They're not going
to
do that.
I had to find a quote. You remember the Thomas More quote? I die the king's faithful servant, but God's first. That's it.
So, okay. What's happening next week, Mark? Do we know?
Yes, we'll be here. Woohoo!
We'll be here. Neil, thank you.
Thank you. Mark, thank you. Steve, thank you. You guys are great. So keep doing it.
All right. Well, folks, what do you think? Do you think this is a place where, you know, we need to do a little bit of work? Do you think this is a way, you know, a field where we need to talk? We didn't even get into the dismantling conversation. I think we kind of did, but we didn't. I don't know. This is one that's near and dear to my heart, and I really do. I really love the fact that we are talking about this more and more and more these days. Because like I said, a few years ago, we weren't talking about it. It wasn't something we discussed or even really understood. But now there's a language around it. And I do give a shout out to good friends at the Baptist Joint Committee on Religious Liberty on Capitol Hill, who have done remarkable work campaigning to help people be aware of this issue. So With all that to be said, we are signing off, and we hope that you have a lovely, lovely, lovely weekend and a great beginning of the week next week. And we do hope that you will come back and spread the word about this podcast. Tell everybody about it, and, you know, listen. And we hope if you like something we say, or you don't like something you say, you'll let us know. Thank you, and God bless.